Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. This edition is published in the early hours of Monday, the 8th of January. Eyewitnesses say dozens of civilians have been killed in an Israeli attack on a house in northern Gaza. A defiant Israeli prime minister says the war will go on.
We are not stopping until we achieve all of its goals. The elimination of Hamas, the return of all of our hostages, and ensuring that Gaza no longer poses a threat to Israel.
Israel also denies Al Jazeera's claims that it's targeting journalists in Gaza. The Bangladeshi prime minister wins a fifth term in office after a boycott by the opposition.
If Bangladesh ruling party Awami League continues like this, this country may be a second North Korea.
And the EU welcomes the resolution of a car number plate dispute between Serbia and Kosovo. Also in the podcast, are new running shoes giving athletes an unfair advantage? And it's a matter on the dance floor, but you better not kill the groove. The song propelled back into the UK charts after more than 20 years. According to Hamas, nearly 23,000 Palestinians have been killed in Gaza since Israel began its offensive there. More than 100 in airstrikes in the past day. But Israel's Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, has told his war cabinet that the fighting will go on until all his government's goals have been achieved. His comments come amid growing frustration and anger at the sheer number of civilian casualties in the Palestinian territory. From Jerusalem, Wira Davis sent this report.
Images coming in from Jabalia in northern Gaza today show bodies lying in the rubble of a destroyed building. Many of them are women and children. Unconfirmed reports say at least 70 people were killed in what was reported to be an Israeli airstrike. The Israeli military has not responded to a BBC request for more information. Another 63 people were also reportedly killed in southern Gaza in the town of Khan Yunis, as Israel continues to target what it says is Hamas infrastructure across the territory. Indeed, despite mounting international pressure over the rising number of casualties and the possibility of a wider regional conflict, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu remains defiant.
We are not stopping until victory. The war must not be stopped until we achieve all of its goals. The elimination of Hamas, the return of all of our hostages, and ensuring that Gaza no longer poses a threat to Israel. I say this to both our enemies and our friends, and we must continue until total victory.
As Mr. Netanyahu spoke, the American Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, continued his tour of Middle Eastern capitals, where increasingly frustrated and occasionally irate regional leaders have been urging him to use Washington's influence with Israel to demand an immediate ceasefire in Gaza.
Wira Davis in Jerusalem. Among the latest fatalities were two Palestinian reporters killed when their car was hit by a drone strike in the south near Rafah. One was Hamza El-Dadou, eldest son of Al Jazeera's Gaza bureau chief Wael El-Dadou. He had already lost his wife and two other children in a strike in October. Al Jazeera accused Israel of targeting journalists and, quote, violating the principles of freedom of the press. Wael spoke at his son's funeral on Sunday.
The world should see with its own eyes and not Israel's eye. They have to listen and see everything that's happening to the Palestinian people. What did Hamza do to Israel? What did the family do to them? What did the civilians in the Gaza Strip do to them?
Well, on his stop-off in Qatar, the US Secretary of State Antony Blinken said he would raise the need to better protect civilians when he heads to Israel this week. He described the deaths of the journalists as an unimaginable tragedy.
The Committee to Protect Journalists has found that now some 70 journalists have been killed in Gaza. One is far too many. And the value that we place upon their work, information, facts to the world, has never been more important. This is why we are pressing the need, not only of making sure that humanitarian assistance can get to people who need it, but that people are protected from harm from this conflict in the first place.
Well, Mark Regev, a senior advisor to the Israeli Prime Minister, said Israel was not to blame for the killings.
Israel does not deliberately target journalists. We are the only country in the Middle East that actually does have a free press. We're the only country in the entire region where the press can write bad things and criticize the leaders of government. That cannot happen, in, I don't think, in any other Middle Eastern country. And to say that Israel deliberately targets the press is ridiculous. We're the only country that actually enshrines a free press. Civilian casualties, our enemy is Hamas, not the population of Gaza. Having said that, if anyone thinks an immediate ceasefire, unconditional, is going to solve anything, it's an illusion. Any ceasefire that leaves Hamas in power just takes us all back to square one. We'll be fighting another Gaza war in 6 months or in a year.
Israeli government advisor Mark Regev talking to the BBC. To no one's surprise, the election in Bangladesh has been won by the Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina, securing her a fifth term in office and a fourth in a row. The poll was boycotted by the main opposition party, the BNP. Turnout is estimated to be as low as 40%, compared to 80% in 2018. In her most recent 14-year stint in charge, Sheikh Hasina has presided over huge economic growth in what was once one of the world's poorest nations. But her government has also been accused of human rights abuses and a crackdown on the opposition. This is something she denies.
We have established people's democratic rights, so I'm trying my best to ensure that democracy should continue in this country.
But the opposition said the way the poll had been conducted was a disgrace to the democratic aspirations of Bangladesh. Abul Moin Khan is a senior member of the BNP party.
It's a shame that after 52 years of independence of Bangladesh, we now have to fight for democracy inside Bangladesh. If Bangladesh ruling party, Awami League, continues like this, this country may be turning into a second North Korea.
Our South Asia correspondent Samira Hussain is in the Bangladeshi capital, Dhaka. She spoke to my colleague, Luquesa Burak.
We do know that the Awami League party led by the Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina has crossed that threshold of winning a clear majority. Now, just how strong that majority is still being worked out. That said, this is an election that pretty much everyone knew what the result was going to be before votes were cast. And that's because the main opposition party, the Bangladesh Nationalist Party, were boycotting these elections. So when you look in terms of the choices that voters had when casting their ballots, it was either vote for the Awami League or vote for the independent candidates. And an overwhelming majority of those independent candidates were supporters of the ruling government.
Samira, what's the atmosphere like in the country at the moment? Because when Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina cast her vote, she described that main opposition party as a terrorist organisation. There are reports of the government cracking down on dissent strongly.
If you are a member of any opposition party that is speaking out against the ruling government, you're probably going to be in a position where it's going to be very difficult to exercise your democratic freedom to protest or make speeches freely. And this is something that has been documented by human rights groups. And that was part of the argument made by the BNP, saying that so many of their leaders and supporters are in prison right now, or they're in hiding because the crackdown on free expression has just been so severe. But when you speak with members of the government, in fact, I spoke with the foreign minister today, and he said, look, these elections were free and fair. You had international observers that came, and they reported that these elections were not rigged. But the BNP said that, look, for them to be responsible to their supporters, they couldn't actually participate in these elections because of this crackdown on any kind of free speech. In a protest back in October of last year, more than 10,000 of their supporters and leaders were arrested, and that's according to Human Rights Watch.
Samira Hussain in Bangladesh talking to Luquesa Burak. For more than 2 years, Serbia and Kosovo have been locked in a sometimes violent dispute over car number plates. The row threatened to tear apart the fragile peace in the region. Now it seems the two sides have quietly reached a resolution. The European Union's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, said it was a positive step towards normalising relations. Our Balkans correspondent, Guy Delaunay, told me what the disagreement was all about and how it was resolved.
Serbia does not recognise Kosovo's unilateral declaration of independence, which happened in 2008. So, of course, Serbia doesn't recognise or didn't recognise Kosovo's vehicle licence plates either. A complicating factor to that was that you've got tens of thousands of ethnic Serbs who live in what is now the northern part of Kosovo, and they were continuing to use Serbian licence plates, which had the initials of towns in North Kosovo. So all of this was causing distinct tensions between Belgrade and Pristina. Pristina, for the past 2.5 years or so, has been insisting that these ethnic Serbs should swap their Serbian-issued number plates for Republic of Kosovo number plates. They were resisting in the north of Kosovo, sometimes with barricades, and we saw some violent flare-ups over the past couple of years surrounding those barricades. And there was also the issue, of course, of whether people with Kosovo number plates would be allowed to drive in Serbia. And we had fudges over the years involving stickers over national insignia and such like. But now the resolution has been reached somewhat quietly and without much fanfare.
Yeah, without much fanfare. Tell us what it involves.
If you're driving now with a Republic of Kosovo number plate, you can drive in Serbia without having to put a sticker over anything. And likewise, if you're driving into Kosovo from Serbia, you don't have to obscure the Serbian insignia on your number plate. The other thing that's happened is that people in North Kosovo, again, quite quietly, when the last deadline came around in December, they swapped their number plates, a lot of people, for Republic of Kosovo number plates because the Serbian government didn't raise any objections.
Guy Delaunay in Belgrade. Now, she is only 25, but Afghanistan's first female commercial pilot has experienced some amazing highs and lows. Mahadese Mirzai made history in 2020 when she became the first woman in Afghanistan to fly an airliner. Less than a year later, the Taliban takeover turned the trailblazing pilot into a refugee, forced to flee for her survival. She's been speaking to the BBC's Janat Jalil about her ordeal and how she's rebuilding her life.
I never thought like I would become a refugee. Like when I became a pilot, it was a big proud moment for everyone in Afghanistan, for me, for my family. We didn't have any women in aviation. And now we had women in aviation. So I was very hopeful about future. I knew like we are going in the right direction.
In male-dominated Afghanistan, it took grit, persistence and hard work for Mohadesi Mirzai to fulfil her dream of becoming the country's first female airline pilot. But less than a year later, the Taliban roared into Kabul, shattering her dreams. She'd left home that morning telling her mother and sisters she'd be back for breakfast the next day. But at the airport, as news broke of the Taliban takeover, hundreds of terrified people stormed onto the runways. Some were so desperate to flee that they clung onto the sides of planes taking off. Mohadesi helped foreign pilots get onto an evacuation flight, but then she was told her own life was in danger too.
We got to that aircraft and they told me, okay, come on in. I can't. What do you mean, come on in? This is my country. I cannot leave my family behind. Like, we are all women, we stick together.
Initially, Mohadesi was flown to Ukraine, but she was denied entry. Months later, Ukraine would be plunged into its own refugee crisis. She ended up in Bulgaria, but once there, she sank into a depression, having lost her job, her home and her family.
Like one day I just woke up and I looked at the mirror. I was crying all the time. And I looked at myself and said, this is not you. You fought so much in Afghanistan to become a pilot. One more time, try it again. Afghan girls are strong, they're courageous and they don't give up easily. I took a paper and a pen and I wrote down. On the 15th of August, I lost my job, I lost my dreams, and I left the country. Next year, on the 15th of August, I will be in the cockpit and I will be flying to show them that they cannot stop us.
And 1 year to the day after the Taliban takeover, she was back in the skies as a pilot.
And on the next year, this exact same day, I took back my hope. I fought for my dreams, I fought for Afghan girls, and I took it back. And I felt amazing.
But Mohadesi is still barred from flying outside Europe, partly because of security concerns. And every time she goes through passport control, the pilot is reminded that she is also a refugee.
I have my uniform on and it's very like respectful uniform. Then I go to the security control and they're like, okay, passports. And everyone gives their passport. Okay, it comes to me and they look at it. They're like, huh, you're from Afghanistan? Yes, sir. You're a refugee? Yes, sir. You're a pilot? Yes, sir. I had interesting reactions. I'll talk about the good ones. They ask me these questions and then they look at me with tearful eyes, but also like they're happy for me and they're proud of it. And they look at me, they're like, bravo. And they're just like, come on in, ma.
And do you want to tell me about the more negative reactions?
Like rest of our pilots, they would just pass and it's just me standing there and they're asking for extra IDs. And sometimes I'm like, what else can I give you?
Since the day she fled the Taliban, Mohadesi has only seen her mother and sisters in video calls. They managed to escape to Canada. But as refugees, they can't come to Europe and she can't go to Canada.
I haven't seen them for 2 years. I know I am an adult and I can manage it by myself, but being away from family, the family that you're always so attached to, like even when I talk about it now, I could cry because I miss them very much.
Mohadesi Mirzai talking to Jannat Jalil. The pioneering British transplant surgeon, Sir Roy Khan, has died at the age of 93. He performed thousands of transplants and was instrumental in the introduction of immunosuppressant drugs, which helped prolong the lives of his patients. Francis Reid looks back at his life.
Sir Roy Khan started his medical training at the age of just 16 in London. He'd wanted to be a surgeon since he was a boy, and he went on to perform a series of world firsts for transplant medicine. It was in 1968 that he led the UK's first liver transplant in Cambridge. 10 years later, he was the first doctor to use an immunosuppressant to reduce organ rejection. Less than a decade after that, he conducted the earliest ever liver, heart and lung transplant, and in the mid-90s, another world first, transplanting stomach, intestine, pancreas, liver and kidney all at the same time. Speaking to the BBC then, he said that some of his ideas had initially been dismissed as impossible.
It's not only the medical profession, I think it's human nature. If you're used to something and it works and it's not too bad as far as you're concerned, you don't want anybody rocking the boat. People who rock the boat are usually regarded as dangerous. They may, in fact, be dangerous, and it's best to suppress them.
You've been regarded as dangerous in your time, have you?
Oh, yes, I think probably still so.
As well as an extensive career and a fellowship at Harvard, he was also known for painting his patients as a way to break down barriers and remove fear for them. He was so well regarded that a hospital in Cambridge named its transplant unit after Sir Roy as an international centre of excellence.
Francis Reid on the life of pioneering transplant surgeon Sir Roy Khan, who's died at the age of 93. And still to come on the Global News podcast...
What I take issue with is this central premise that we're all supposed to feel that the people gathered in Davos are pursuing social goals that are universally applicable. They're going there to do business and make deals.
Ahead of the annual get-together in Davos, we ask, what is the World Economic Forum all about? The general election in the Democratic Republic of Congo in December was dogged by delays, logistical challenges and allegations of fraud. About 100,000 candidates were standing in the polls for different posts. The only result announced so far, a landslide victory for the incumbent president Felix Tshisekedi, has been widely disputed. While Congo waits to see the outcome of the other elections, the UN's top human rights expert has expressed serious concern about a rise in hate speech and calls for violence, as I heard from our Africa regional editor David Bamford.
In many ways, the presidential election itself was the easy part. What also happened on December the 20th were all the legislative and local elections, and that's where the concern is, because the results have not yet been declared. That's where the violence is more likely to take place. And this message from Volker Turk is really about what he fears will happen as the election results start to be announced locally.
Yeah, and just remind us of the potential for trouble in Congo. It is a huge country and lots of different ethnic groups live there.
To run an election in a country such as Congo with 250 ethnic groups, with all the rivalries, with the civil war going on in the east, it's going to be difficult in any case, and in particular places like North and South Kivu, where there's the M23 rebels and other rebel groups stirring up the situation. Kasai and Katanga, well known for violence in the past, they've really got their hands full. I mean, the election chief, Denis Kadima, is doing all he can to try and keep things calm, but he's in a very difficult situation.
David Bamford, our Africa regional editor. It is less than 2 years since Emmanuel Macron was re-elected as French president, but already there's talk that his power is beginning to ebb away. He's not able to stand in the next election due in 2027, when the far-right leader Marine Le Pen will be hoping to succeed him. Johnny Diamond asked Sophie Pedder, Paris bureau chief for The Economist, what's gone wrong for Mr. Macron?
He failed to win a majority at parliamentary elections, and every single piece of legislation since the elections of 2022 has had to be passed either by forcing it through parliament using a sort of override clause or ad hoc stitching together of votes and coalitions that last as long as the vote does.
There is talk of perhaps a cabinet reshuffle, perhaps a new prime minister. Will that help?
It will be a chance to reset, you know, but that's all limited within the context of having no parliamentary majority, which will continue to make life difficult for him.
Sophie Pedder of The Economist. Well, Marc Ferracci is the vice president of Emmanuel Macron's party in the French parliament. He's also an old friend and was best man at his wedding. Does he feel gloomy about the next 3 years?
I don't, because I think there is still room for President Macron to govern. He's definitely not a lame duck president. More than 50 bills have been passed since the general election, and that shows that the majority stick together. So I'm not pessimistic. We have achieved some good results, but there are many fractures in the French society. We have seen that last July when there were riots in the country. But we have also assets. The strength of the French economy is an asset. And I think that there is still resilience of the French society as a whole.
When I was travelling around the country during the election campaign, it was very clear there was a big gap. They felt a sense of disconnect between Paris and much of the rest of the country. Do you think that Mr. Macron has been successful in bridging the gap between the governed and the government? Because many have suggested again that he has been part of the problem there.
There is an anger which is directed towards President Macron in France. You raise a very important issue. We need to change people's lives everywhere in the country. And there are many parts of the French territory that obviously didn't see the results that we have achieved, and especially in big cities. The fact that some people have this feeling of disconnection is a very strong fuel, especially for the extreme right party. So I think that we need to achieve much more results and to show that it's our reforms, our actions that drive these results.
You mentioned the threat of the far right. If in 2027 the presidency is taken by Marine Le Pen, what kind of legacy is that for President Macron?
Well, we're going to do everything we can to avoid this. Obviously, it would be a failure, but I think that it's far from being a certainty.
Marc Ferracci talking to Johnny Diamond. A new super shoe developed to shatter the world marathon record sold out within minutes of going on sale last week. It was worn by Kenyan runner Kelvin Kiptum in Chicago in October, when he became the first man to finish a marathon in under 2 hours and 1 minute. There was a similar frenzy over another shoe, worn by Tigist Assefa, who broke the women's world marathon record in Berlin in September. Chris Dennis is a UK sports journalist who covers athletics. He's been considering whether so-called super shoes are making life too easy for elite runners.
Surely now it's a question of when, rather than if, a marathon will be run legally in under 2 hours. When the Kenyan Kelvin Kiptum won in Chicago in October, he moved the men's world record to within 35 seconds of the magic mark. But he also lopped an astonishing 34 seconds off the previous record held by Eliud Kipchoge, widely regarded as the greatest marathon runner in history. Of the top 20 fastest marathon times in history, 16 of the men's and 17 of the women's have been run since 2019. So what's happening here? Are athletes getting fitter and stronger as well as quicker? Quite possibly so. But the 2019 date is significant. This marked the arrival of the so-called super shoe, which has revolutionised road running. The carbon fibre plate, embedded within a featherweight foam sole, produces more recoil on impact, giving the athlete a greater energy return. The super shoes allow athletes to train harder and recover more quickly. Not surprisingly, the arrival of the super shoe has divided opinion. Critics call it technological doping, plastic athletics, which devalues the currency of previous records and tarnishes the performances of former record holders such as Haile Gebrselassie and Paula Radcliffe. Many are calling for a line to be drawn in the record books separating the pre- and post-super shoe era. But supporters say the shoe technology is just one element alongside advances in diet, training, refueling and pacemaking. As Eliud Kipchoge, who ran the world's first sub-2-hour marathon in an experiment 4 years ago, is quick to point out, it's the athlete who does the running. And here's Eamon Martin, the last British male to win the London Marathon in 1993.
I like the new technology. I think it's going to happen. You're not going to stay still in this current world we live in, so you have to kind of work out a way of embracing it.
There's no doubt that shoes are getting ever stronger and lighter. The sports governing body, World Athletics, says records are always set using the best technology in existence at the time. As long as the shoes are available to all athletes and the soles don't exceed 40 millimetres in thickness, they're perfectly legal. Love them or loathe them, the super shoe will play a key part in the race to the first ever sub-2-hour marathon. And it's not just a race between the athletes, it's a battle of the brands as well.
Chris Dennis reporting. The World Economic Forum starts in a week in the Swiss resort of Davos. It's an occasion when business leaders, billionaires and other big names rub shoulders and talk about putting the world to rights. But is anything concrete actually ever achieved? Peter Goodman is the global economics correspondent for the New York Times and author of a book called Davos Man, How the Billionaires Devoured the World. Paul Henley asked him if the book reflected a certain cynicism about the event.
I think cynicism is the enemy of good journalism, but I'd certainly call myself highly dubious that the people who are, by any reasonable measure, the ultimate beneficiaries of the status quo are going to go to some mountaintop in the Swiss Alps and decide to change the status quo for the betterment of everyone else. What I take issue with is this central premise that we're all supposed to feel that the people gathered in Davos are pursuing social goals that are universally applicable. They're going there to do business, they're in make deals. And so for journalists, it's useful, but the whole thing is totally performative and increasingly irrelevant.
So why aren't more people asking what you call the difficult questions? Is there much kowtowing?
Yeah. Access journalism is a problem in much of the world. This idea that if I'm kind to the people I'm interacting with, I'll get to see them again. And that's supposed to ultimately put you in position to learn things that no one else would be in a position to learn, which generally doesn't happen. Once you start playing the access game, your journalism is essentially corrupted and you start thinking about your access as an end in and of itself. So the social construct of the event that convenes in Davos every year is all about buying into this notion that just by being here, we're all committed to improving the state of the world. And therefore, all problems are really just issues of communication. We all need to understand one another better, and then we can figure out how to make drugs and vaccines more affordable. We can come up with solutions to the lack of affordable housing around the world. Of course, that's a fairy tale. It's not about communication. It's about power. And the state of the world is very much an expression of people who have power using that power to undermine our political systems in their own interests, often to the detriment of everyone else. So I reject this idea that we can just entrust the billionaire class with figuring out how to deal with economic inequality. They're the winners of economic inequality, and they're seeking to perpetuate it.
So if the billionaires at Davos are intent on devouring the world, are the world leaders similarly intent on devouring it, those that aren't billionaires themselves?
I mean, world leaders, depending upon which political system you come from, have to deal with the billionaire class. I mean, oftentimes being successful in business and making a fortune is a prerequisite for political success, or at least ingratiating yourself with people who have the money to fund your dreams. So I would argue that what we've seen time and again is that the billionaire class has managed to persuade the political class that what I call the cosmic lie in the book is truth. This idea that if we organize our economic systems around making it easier for billionaires to make their next billion, the benefits will just magically trickle down to everyone else, something that has happened in reality zero times. But we keep trying buying it, because the part where the billionaires benefit from tax cuts and deregulation, that part really works out. And they use that cash often in the service of political campaigns. And so there's a real nexus between the political class and the billionaire class.
Peter Goodman, global economics correspondent for The New York Times. The British singer Sophie Ellis-Bextor is having something of a renaissance thanks to the Golden Globe-nominated film Saltburn. Directed by Emerald Fennell, it's the story of an increasingly debauched friendship between an Oxford University student and his aristocratic classmate. And combined with a TikTok trend, it's given a 2001 hit a new lease of life, as Will Chalk explains. It's murder on the dance floor,
but you better not kill the groom. If you've seen Saltburn, this song will conjure images of a stark naked Barry Keoghan dancing through the halls of a mansion house. Take care if you're operating heavy machinery right now. Thanks to its featuring in the film's climax and the subsequent TikTok trend, with people, mostly fully clothed, recreating the scene, Murder on the Dance Floor has climbed back into the UK top 10 for the first time in more than 20 years. Sophie Ellis-Bextor told the BBC what she makes of it.
I was approached by Emerald Fennell quite a few months ago now, actually, about using Murder on the Dance Floor in Saltburn. And when you're approached for approval of a song, you get a little synopsis of how the song will be used. So it said that it was going to use the song in its entirety while the main character dances in a stately home at the end of the film. Oh, and he will be completely naked for the entire dance routine. And I gave my approval very fast, because not only was I a fan of Emerald's work, I thought, I really have to see that.
Now, if a viral film or TV show bringing a vintage pop hit to a new, younger audience sounds familiar, that's probably because it is. It didn't hurt me. Yeah, yeah. Do you wanna feel how it feels? Yeah, yeah. After featuring in the Netflix series Stranger Things in 2022, Kate Bush's 1985 hit Running Up That Hill was pushed to the top of the UK charts for the first time. The singer spoke to the BBC.
Exciting, yeah. But it's quite shocking, really, isn't it? The whole world's gone mad.
37 years is the longest time, I believe, it's a song has taken to get to number one. And in America, it's your first ever top 10 hit in the US, which I didn't know.
What's really wonderful, I think, is that this is a whole new audience who, in a lot of cases, they've never heard of me, and I love that. If you think you're getting
away, I will prove you wrong. Well, back to Saltburn, because as it stands, Murder on the Dance Floor has never been a UK number one. It's currently at number 8, but Sophie Ellis-Bextor says she's just enjoying the ride.
What's happened with Murder on the Dance Floor is absolutely extraordinary. It actually feels really magical. And if I'm honest, I don't think I've completely processed it, really. It's extraordinary.
Sophie Ellis-Bextor ending that report by Will Chalk. And that's all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back very soon. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll and produced by Emma Joseph. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.
Hey, you. Yeah, talking to you. Welcome to Audible, where there's endless ways to ignite your imagination, like chase your thrills, slay your demons, even journey into the great unknown. And if you're lucky, discover someone, something new to love. Hear the latest audiobooks, podcasts, and originals at audible.ca.